GPB News, it's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Halloween isn't just for kids.
We as humans love to be scared.
Today we hear ghost stories from some of the most notorious spots in the state. First though, we talked last week with actor Bruce Campbell about making horror movies that hold up.
Evil Dead actually, viewed in drive-ins when it first came out. We would study the movies that were out, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Revenge of the Cheerleaders, and if there was a part in these movies that was lousy, the actual viewers would turn their car headlights on and honk their horn until it stopped being lousy. And we went, oh my God, this is our audience right here. These are instant critics.
And we asked for your favorite horror movies. Here are your first thoughts.
Hi, it's Ed Hall calling from Atlanta's eerie Beecher Donnelly neighborhood. My three top horror films: Jaws, because it's the funniest scary movie you'll ever see.
It's the swimming with bow-legged women.
Aegon, because it's absolutely the creepiest horror film you'll ever see. And then a toss-up between Blair Witch Project and Cloverfield for being the absolutely most dread-inducing.
How would we have, just made a campsite in between three piles of rocks just by coincidence? You don't think this is strange?
We love getting your movie recommendations and all your other thoughts. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. Georgia native Karen Slaughter has written several international bestsellers, and they are not for the faint of heart. These are complicated, tough, and realistic thrillers. Her latest is The Good Daughter. It's about a terrifying event that rips apart a family and the small town where they live. I spoke to Karen earlier this year. So I've read a lot of your books. This one feels quite different than any of the others I've ever read. It basically takes a crime after it's solved and explains what happens, the ripple effects of a violent crime. What was the purpose of this particular novel?
Well, it was very pointedly that I set out to do something different. I love crime novels. I'm a crime writer. This is a thriller. So, yeah, a crime is solved, but there's another crime you have to figure out that propels the plot. But I wanted to talk about what violence leaves behind and how people get up the next day who are, family members or even the community. Because anytime you're touched by crime or you witness crime or you're a victim of crime, it changes who you are. And that's always interested me. I mean, people know I grew up in Jonesboro, about 45 minutes from Atlanta, during the time of the Atlanta child murders. And I saw at a very real level how that changed Jonesboro. I mean, we were very far away. I'm obviously not the type, or I don't fit the pattern of the victim of these crimes. But it terrified me. It really changed our lives. And, we weren't even close to what was happening.
What do you think is the specific impact on a small town, which is really the town itself sort of becomes a character in this novel? But you've written crimes that are based in an urban setting and crimes that are based in rural settings. Is part of it that in a small town there's no escaping, there's no anonymity?
I think that's a big part of it. And I also think, I'm writing about a fictional town in North Georgia. I go up to write in North Georgia. I have for almost 20 years. I love it up there. My dad lives up there. It's a wonderful place. But, this town I go to in Blue Ridge has had some really shocking crimes happen there. And it's really interesting to see how it's changed the fabric of the community when these bad things happen. And sometimes the excuses people make when bad things happen, if it's someone who's an insider who's been there all along, they're much more likely to make excuses for them as opposed to if a crime was committed by an outsider.
And there's also sort of a lot of moral gray area, decisions that people made where you can kind of understand, but it seems like it was wrong. I mean, you're dealing with moral ambiguities in some sense.
Absolutely. And, I looked at this novel after I wrote that opening prologue. I thought this has the potential to have the scope of a Victorian novel, talking about family, society, haves and have-nots, the poverty gap, and just within the crime and punishment arena, you have
absolutely
an indigent client. I write about lawyers. Don't worry. They're not all horrible. that it is fiction, right? But just how difficult it is in the criminal justice system for someone to get a fair hearing if they don't have the money to buy that access. So I wanted to talk about all those things. I thought it was important.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with crime novelist Karen Slaughter. Another, not just the event itself, but in terms of examining the real aftershocks, is there is an instance of rape, mm-hmm. which is graphic and upsetting, and this is something that not just the victim, but that the rest of the people who surround it don't get over for 30 years. Why did you want to write about rape?
Well, you know, I've written about it in past books. I think the reason it resonates so much, I wouldn't necessarily say it's the most graphic thing I've written about, but I think if you care about the characters, the crimes have more impact on you as a reader. So that's always my first challenge, is to make sure you understand this character, you know who they are, so when something bad happens, you really feel it. But there's a line in the novel where Rusty, the father, is talking about rape. He will defend anyone in his legal practice, but he won't defend rapists because he thinks that rape is a crime that is worse than murder. And I think in a lot of ways it is, because it takes your ease, it takes who you are as a person, it just takes all that away from you. You're never the same again, and certainly there are a lot of people who have experienced this. I mean, hundreds of thousands of women in America, millions in the world who have experienced this crime, and they I mean, it's amazing how they just have managed to get past it or move past it, or, you know, how they deal with it. But I think that the fact that they never feel that same ease as they did before is, at some level, just one of the most terrific crimes you can commit in society. There's a reason why it's used as a weapon in war, because it's devastating.
Do you think a thriller as a genre is an escapist genre?
I do. And, you know, it seems counterintuitive because I'm writing about some really tough stuff. But I think on some level, there are a lot of women out there. And, you know, let's be honest, 85% of all fiction buyers are women, and they love their thrillers. Thank goodness for me. And I'm a thriller reader. I love it. And, you know, there's part of it is, thank God that's not me. I think another part of it is, as a woman writing about these topics, I think it's important because, especially rape, but murder, and we don't really talk about stuff like that, especially in the South, you know, where we kind of whisper words to each other when horrible things happen. But, you know, with violence against women, if you look at the FBI charts of the from ages 0 to 45 for women, if you look at the mortality rates, in the top five, from 0 to 45, one of the top five reasons women die is homicide. And if a woman is pregnant, it's the number one reason, homicide. So it's a dangerous thing to be a woman. And I think being a woman, writing about these dangers that all women know about, is a bit cathartic for me and cathartic for the reader.
These are very difficult times that we're living in right now, regardless
yes.
of your gender or politics. And I wonder what you think, how you think the job of an artist may have changed, if it has. The job of trying to help your readers or whomever else, the society at large, grapple with what's happening?
I think primarily for me, my books are to entertain people, right? So if you just talk about as a level of escapism, that's there. But if you want a deeper reading, there's there. One thing I'm very concerned about right now is how divisive everything is. And I grew up in a small town. I write in a small town. I love small towns. But if you look at somewhere like Georgia, you know, the old joke is without Atlanta, Georgia would be Mississippi. And the fact is, Atlanta and the metro area's tax base make small towns possible. You know, our tax dollars subsidize electricity, water, disability, some Social Security, health care, children's lunches, all that sort of thing. And I worry that it's becoming so divisive that people in big cities are going to say, why am I helping people who hate me? And that's a big concern for me. I think that we need to work our way back and understand, whether you live in Atlanta or Blue Ridge or anywhere else, we all want to feel safe. We all want to have our kids go to nice schools. We want to have a nice job. We want to feel secure. We all want that. We're all Americans. And I think we need to get back to that because this separation is very worrisome to me.
So do you end up having people complain about things in your books that you never thought would be divisive? That they
absolutely
take as...
You know, everything is so political now. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine who wrote about a school shooting, Alifair Burke. She's a wonderful writer. She wrote a book called The X. And she said, why are school shootings political now? I just don't understand that. And they are. And there's nothing political about it. A child is murdered. A child is so angry he picks up a gun. That's something we need to talk about as a society, not as a political thing, but as a what the hell is happening thing.
And there's actually a character in your book who is trans. And I thought as I was reading that in the book, it's just not a thing. That's
yeah.
just who that person is. And then I wonder, I wonder if someone's going to read this and think that you're trying to make a political statement.
Probably. But, you know, that character is based on someone I knew in a small town. So, you know, the thing is, I love this line in the book. It's something that my grandmother used to say. Every place has someone who doesn't belong. That's what makes them belong. And especially in small towns, you know, I've been touring in Europe, I've been to Germany and England and the Netherlands and all over, and Europe is basically small towns. And the same cast of characters in these small towns you can find in North Georgia or South Georgia or anywhere, you know, Idaho, name it. You know, you have the family that has a lot of money, the poor family, the kind of shady criminal family, the loose women, the hypocritical pastors, all of that you can find in any iteration in any small town. So when I'm writing about somewhere like Pikeville, which is fictional, I'm very aware that I'm kind of borrowing on people I grew up with and that it's a universal language.
And we only have a minute left, but another universal theme is this idea of secrets and how harmful they can be to a certain extent.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which I assume is a constant thriller theme. Like,
well, it's a Southern theme, right? Because I remember my grandmother used to take me to church and she would introduce me to her friends. And as soon as they'd turn around, she'd say something awful like, well, you know, she drinks, right? I mean, when I was at church, everybody had a horrible secret. My grandmother knew it.
That's crime novelist Karen Slaughter. Her latest book is The Good Daughter. Just ahead, do you believe in ghosts? Savannah's tourism board sure hopes you do. First, though, spooky stories from all over the state. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're in Halloween mode today with some uncanny tales, but look, not every story is scary. David Hurt is a professional storyteller. This month he shared Southern ghost stories at the Art Station Theater in Stone Mountain, and we asked him to share one with us.
I'm going to tell you about these two boys, Gerald and Jerome. They was Potter Mill boys, and they was no good at all. Why, every time they could get into mischief, they would. I want you to know. Why, they even took Granny Levitt and tied her high boot laces together, and when the old woman stood up, why, she went to falling over, and all them boys did was laugh. Oh, they would lock people in the outhouse. They'd burn the apple tree. Whatever they could think they could get away with, they was always in trouble. But their mama always stood by them. Well, one day, this creature appeared in the area. It was half dog, half wild creature. It lived in the swamp, down in the bog. And when you got a wild creature on one end and a dog on the other, you've got a wog. And, well, the wog living in the bog, everybody called it the bog wog, and it was here to get rid of the children what done mischief. Oh, I don't mean children that wouldn't eat their green peas at dinner. I'm talking people that done bad things, kind of like the Potter's Mill boys. Well, they was out one night a-playing around, having a good time, causing all sorts of trouble, when they heard in the leaves a rustling. And they seen this little creature go scuttering across, and, well, they made no mind of that and went on back to their place. Now, their mama had gone on to bed, don't you know? And they were there, but the bogwog had creeped up to their cabin because they was prime targets to get rid of. Well, here it was, don't you know, that they hear this slithering and whatnot around the cabin, and all of a sudden this slimy green tongue come in underneath the door frame. Well, they didn't know what to do with it, so it wrapped around one of the boys and had his arm and was pulling him toward the door, trying to get him out there. And when the other boy's other part, Jerome, he grabs a poker and gives it a whack on the tongue, and that thing runs away. And now they know the Bogwog is after them. So they try to plan some sort of attack. They set things up. They move into the little shed out back so that their mama won't be disturbed. They're there, waiting for it. They've got a nice little fire built, and this thing comes in again, that slimy tongue coming in, trying to get him, and it comes in and grabs a hold of one of the boys again and tries to drag him out, and that's when they grab that thing and wrap that tongue around the bedpost so it can't get out, and they start to pull it and drag that thing in and throw it in a bag and take it down to the creek to throw it away and get rid of it. It escapes and chases him back to the house. And them boys is now in fear. They're in that cabin one more time, and this thing's a-banging at the door, a-clawing on the ceilings, a-headed in the roof, and comes down the chimney, all the way down into that hot fire. They grab it with a poker, throw it to the ground. They get one of them hot coals and wrap its tongue around it, and it goes a-screaming out of the door. They think they're safe, but it comes back the next night. And that's when the boys see what they've got to do. They have got to get rid of this creature. So that tongue comes out again. One of them grabs it. They take a hatchet and chop that tongue off, and it goes to slithering out the door, and that creature goes to screaming down into the woods, never to be heard from again. And they go, "Mama, Mama, look what has happened. We've been saved by the Bogwog." She knowed her boys was bad, and if the Bogwog was going to get them, well, maybe they just had to have a lesson taught to them, and she whooped them both good. Now, they knowed a couple of things here that they was able to figure out. Number one, they was bad boys and had to change their way. But number two, their mama loved them, and she'd stand by them in everything. And that's really all a son needs. Now, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
That's professional storyteller David Hurt. Each year, he tells Southern ghost stories at the Art Station Theater in Stone Mountain. Hurt says many of his ghost stories aren't actually meant to be scary, but we wouldn't be doing our job on Halloween if we didn't at least try to frighten you. So enter Jeffrey Kilpatrick. He's a lecturer at the University of Georgia, and he has a new collection of scary stories that take place in Athens. The collection's called Hometown Horrors, Terrifying Tales of Athens, Volume 1, Bloody Boulevard. One of these tales revolves around two University of Georgia students who want to learn more about a cult in town called the Inner Circle. We asked Jeffrey Kilpatrick to tell us more.
Carlos and Ben are two undergraduate students from the university, and they're friends. They're just hanging out at Automatic Pizza. All their friends are out of town. Town's kind of dead. Athens dead. It's a game day, but it's an away game. So they're just trying to come up with something to do. The waiter, you know, has been listening to them talk about what they want to do, batting around some different stories, and the waiter's like, "Well, I got one for you." Waiter at Automatic says, "Hey, why don't you go over to Old Pal, check it out. There's a cult there." Old Pal's a bar, a neighborhood bar there across the street on Prince Avenue. So the Inner Circle is a group of old men that from Athens and surrounding areas that get together once a month, generally under the full moon, and they conduct some sort of ritual. Tends to involve blood, tends to involve a rare drink that they've concocted, and the highlight of the drink is that they have a white olive that they soak in red liquor. The liquor soaks into the veins, which makes the olive look quite close to being an eyeball. According to the stories, the drink is supposed to make you stronger, make you see in the dark, that kind of thing. Now, whether or not that depends on if you're part of the cult or not seems to be in question, because members of the cult that do have the drink seems to have the reverse effect on them, kind of paralyzes them, essentially. So they kind of lose control of their body. Their head starts spinning. They don't lose consciousness, but everything else becomes unusable. What ends up happening is Ben and Carlos, they don't interrupt the ritual that's going on, but the cult basically takes advantage of them, gives them the drink. We see this mostly from Ben's point of view, but it did not have a good effect on him. Head starts spinning, kind of starts hearing voices, weird things start happening, like wood starts to melt, and basically he loses control of his body. Everything becomes paralyzed, but he's still conscious, so he's still able to see what's going on. Then we find out they may have done the same thing to Carlos. Most likely did the same thing to Carlos. We see him lying on the floor. He's missing an eye. The cult likes to take the eyes out of their victims. And they have a little fun with Ben in the sense that Carlos came in earlier. They apparently did this to him and then made Ben eat the eye of his friend. It does not end well for Ben. He does not get initiated into the cult. But he also doesn't make it out of the bar alive.
That's University of Georgia lecturer Jeffrey Kilpatrick. He's the author of Hometown Horrors, Terrifying Tales of Athens, Volume 1, Bloody Boulevard. And we would love to hear your favorite scary story, even if it's one you made up. Call us at 404-500-9457. Rome, Georgia flooded in 1886. According to local lore, the waters rose high enough for a steamboat to float down Broad Street. That's the town's main thoroughfare. This event inspired the city to elevate the street and all the buildings along it. Business owners recently opened up their basement doors so people could tour the remains of old Rome, and GPB's Emily Curitan sent this audio postcard.
I'm Catherine Jackson. You'll go to 5 different locations, first levels and basements throughout Broad Street, just to see the different history and the different levels. So.
All right, everybody come this way, please.
So I'm Rob, and I volunteer for the Sexual Assault Center on things like this and fundraising, and I'm a born and raised in Rome, Georgia, and that's about me.
Keep coming. Don't be afraid. You might be afraid when we're done, but not right now. Keep coming. Come on. Come on. Everybody come on down. Come on. Come on. You will see that right back there is a walled-up window. Now think about the fact that we are underground. They're not going to put a window to look at the dirt that is underneath the street. And I'm standing in the elevator. So if I'm bringing stuff in through the back, probably off of wagons, bringing it to an elevator, what am I carrying? Anybody guess? No guesses. Cotton? Maybe. Probably not. If it is, it's not much. What's that?
Supplies.
Maybe food. Maybe clothing. Maybe other things, maybe a little bit of cotton, right? So we know that William Whitley owned this building. William Whitley was a merchant. He registered himself in the city as a merchant. We also know that William Whitley registered himself as the undertaker for Rome, Georgia. So picture that maybe this next floor might have been the grocery store, the general store with corn and beef, and the next one might be the undertaker. So you have the bodies on the one side and you have the corn and the beef on the other side.
If you have questions, please feel free to ask. Seriously, come over and look at it. I wouldn't stand on the elevator itself, not because it won't hold you, but because there's a crack.
So there are some places in Rome, Georgia that are haunted. I believe it. You were probably up at the theater. You probably heard about Ruby and or the others.
Did she tell you about Ruby?
I bet it's the same story.
I'm Hannah Cook.
Well, the story, there used to be a trolley car on Broad. Of course, that's gone too once they raised the road and everything. But the story is that this little girl came and she was getting off the trolley and she fell and she got hit. And she got up and she went in and she watched all day because they would have back-to-back features. And when the day was over, she was gone. And she was dead. I'd end the theater like doing something she loved, watching these movies.
Do I believe in ghosts? I don't know. I'm not going to say no because I've never seen one. But I'm not going to say yes because I've never seen one. Rebecca Sharp. We live in Collinsville, Alabama, just about 45 minutes away.
New group. All right. Hey, guys. How's it going? Pay attention to this. Don't trip over it.
I'm Chris Jackson.
This will be the trap door I'm talking about, okay? I'm going to go ahead and walk down.
but I've kind of helped put together the tour along with Mark Cochran, who's a local architect, and then a bunch of volunteers.
This is a water-powered engine that actually powered the elevator that brought cotton up and down.
My favorite thing about this is that we're upstairs in a bike shop, which is currently, you know, functioning as a business. There's, you know, there was a guy up there buying a bike while we were coming through, and then you walk down a flight of stairs and literally you're in the 1800s.
That was used in order to be able to sell cotton. Because what block is this?
Cotton.
Right,
cotton.
Absolutely. And they call it that because cotton was king in the late 1800s when this building was built. And
that piece was produced by GPB's Emily Curitan. To see pictures of her journey to underground Rome, visit gpbnews.org. The longer a building has been around, the more likely people will say that it's haunted. The Fox Theater in Atlanta opened in 1929, and some say a few of the millions who've passed through those doors still remain. The theater hosts ghost tours this time of year, and we sent producer Sean Powers to learn about spirits that refuse to leave even after the curtain comes down.
If you have a ghost app on your phone, go ahead and turn it on. If you see it working, don't tell me till the end of the tour. My name is Anna Seaton, and I'm a tour guide at the Fox Theater. That's the organist. You're going to hear strange noises coming from in there. There really is a live person at the organ. All right, so let's start with the beginning of what was here with the property. Now, I'm not going to go too far back. I'm going to go to the Civil War. 1863 to 1864, this was Fortification K. We had 25 fortification areas in Atlanta to protect us. So if there's Civil War history here, then that means there's going to be Civil War death here. We're going to probably have some ghosts from that time period, and we do. We have a Confederate soldier that sometime is seen in one of the upper windows when people are out on the street and happen to look up. Instead of lingering in the light of the lobby, let's go down where there's dark places to explore. This elevator is original to the Fox Theater, 1929. It's an Otis, and it was the first automated elevator in Atlanta. Now, I had heard that there was a ghost that rode on the elevator we just rode on, and somebody told me 6th floor, somebody told me 7th floor, but you press a button to a floor and it goes to one of those 2 floors. That's kind of a curious thing, and that it smells like roses. And I have no experience with that, and I make it a policy not to talk about the ghosts around the elevators or on the elevators, because I've had them pull pranks on me. Either that or it's a mechanical malfunction that happened 4 times in a row, you know? This is the freight elevator. Everything that's going on the stage that comes off the alley is going on this elevator. It jiggles a little when it starts connecting. When we get up to the top, we're going to go off at stage level. So I want to tell you what to expect. When the theater is empty, we're not doing a show, it's considered to be dark. When it's dark, there's a ghost light on the edge of the stage so nobody falls off. There's nobody here, but we leave a light on anyway. Now, the story behind that is you don't want a ghost to take ownership of the theater and start doing malicious things. And so you have a ghost light there to tell him it's not okay. You also have a ghost light there on other theories to show them where they can perform. My favorite recommendation on a ghost light is to have it there so I don't see them perform. Okay. Oh my gosh. These are your organ pipes on either side. Bob Van Kamp's ashes are in there. They're in an urn.
Bob Van Kamp played organ at the Fox Theater for years. He mentored current Fox Theater organist Rick McGee. Sean found McGee in the theater in front of his organ, and McGee says he remembers Bob Van Kamp very well.
I would work with Bob, and he'd show me different registrations and things that he would do, and I would incorporate that. You could sit and listen to him play for hours, and your ears didn't get weary. I mean, he was first the music and then the instrument. And so he's the one I patterned most of my playing after because he's the one I grew up listening to. I haven't seen Bob here. I feel like I talk to him all the time, you know, and a lot of times when I play things, I'm sure he's up there listening, going, can feel him helping you along, and it's just fine, you know.
When you eventually pass on, would you ever want to haunt the Fox Theater?
Well, I sincerely hope that maybe I can join Bob and some of them here, and, you know, maybe we'll start a whole club, you know. But, oh, yeah, I have no problems hanging around. I mean, it's fun to stay here and mess with folks. Thank you.
Our thanks to the Fox Theater for the haunted tour. For a look back at the Fox Theater's long history, visit gpbnews.org. Just ahead, our unearthly Georgia tour continues with a trip to the most haunted city in the state. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. Tomorrow, we'll talk about how Amazon changed Seattle. The online retail giant brought jobs and many new people to Washington's largest city, but also some undesirable side effects. A slew of Georgia cities hope to become home to a second company headquarters. So, would you want Amazon in your town? Call us at 404-500-9457. You might get your deliveries that much faster, right? Leave us a message and be sure to join us for that conversation. It's not all that hard to find a ghost hunter these days. All you have to do is turn on the TV.
On this episode of Ghost Hunters.
I'm hearing footsteps in here. Oh my God.
It seems like in Deadwood, everything centers around a few spirits.
There's a lot of anger towards the living.
If you want to track down a ghost hunter in Georgia, I recommend you visit Savannah. It is a city built on the dead, after all. Ryan Dunn is the lead investigator for the Savannah Ghost Research Society, and they conduct free paranormal investigations in Savannah and around the world. I spoke to him last year. Okay, so you did an investigation at the old Chatham County Jail, which was reportedly quite haunted. In this recording, your wife, Kim, is in the third floor medical office, and you think you hear two spirits talking about her. So take a listen here.
But I can't.
What do you think we're hearing there?
It sounded like there was two spirits actually communicating. We caught the first one saying, "I'm about to get her good." And then a few seconds later, another one said, "I know." And we didn't hear anything on location, but upon playing the recording back, we actually had the voices imprinted into our recorder.
Okay, let's take another listen so listeners can listen for that.
But I can't.
Do you have to use, do you just use a regular old microphone and recorder to get recordings like this?
You can. We use a lot of high-end audio recorders that pick up higher frequencies, but you can use just a normal audio recording device that you can find at Walmart or anywhere else as well.
What other equipment do you bring with you when you're going to do a paranormal investigation?
We use a lot of temperature gauges, electromagnetic field detectors, thermal cameras. We do a DVR camera system that has infrared, so we use full dark and a lot of night vision technology as well.
Now, in some of these cases, you debunk the idea of ghosts, right?
Correct. You know, it's not always a paranormal explanation. There have been many cases where we've, you know, had houses settling or wind blowing through windows when people think they're hearing voices, and we always try to find a rational explanation first.
Tell me about the time you had somebody call and complain that her doorbell kept ringing and nobody was there, right?
Right. We had a case at the Amethyst Inn back in 2011, and one of her complaints was that the doorbell would ring and she would answer the door immediately and there would be no one there. And we actually debunked that as being her neighbors. When they would turn their garage door sensor on or to open their garage door, it would trigger the sensor in the doorbell, make it go off.
Okay, so not a ghost, actually their next door neighbor, and they need to reprogram their garage door opener. But let's go back to that old Chatham County Jail. And as far as you're concerned, the old Chatham County Jail, say that six times fast, is actually haunted, right, Ryan?
Extremely. We caught over 50 audio recordings. We caught a thermal image of a shadow figure standing right outside of one of the cells that was about 6.5 to 7 feet tall. So we caught a lot of evidence of the paranormal at the old jail.
Okay, so let's take a listen to a recording you made inside one of those cells. Let's hear it again, because you guys heard something in this recording. I don't hear anything. What did you hear here?
See, I heard "help me" and then "help" a few seconds later. So about 2 seconds into the recording, you can hear a whisper of "help me" and then "help" a few seconds afterwards.
Okay, I'm going to play it one more time. I mean, you must have to blast these through your headphones to hear some of these things that you're talking about.
That one actually comes out a little clear to me. I can hear it pretty
really?
Clear, but, you know, definitely. But,
My
you know, some people.
My hearing must be deteriorating. Sorry, I interrupt you. Go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, no. Yeah, definitely. You know, I hear the help me and the help. It is a whisper, but I definitely clearly hear it. But, you know, some people do have trouble hearing some, and some hear it a little clearer than others.
Do most people that call you for these paranormal investigations, are they trying to determine if they have a ghost, or they think they're pretty sure they have a ghost and they want to get rid of it?
Both. You know, a lot of the businesses in Savannah do not want to get rid of their ghosts. It's good for business. We are one of the most haunted cities in America. But a lot of the private residence cases do ask for us to try to get rid of it. We actually had the Catholic Church exercise a house for us about 5 months ago from a case.
Did it work?
No, they have new tenants, and they were there for a month. They signed a year lease, and they moved out after a month because one of the guys was picked up and thrown across the room.
Okay. We actually asked our listeners if they've believed in ghosts, and I want to throw that out to our listeners also. If you believe in ghosts or if you have a ghost story for us, then be sure to give us a call, or you can tweet us or post it at Facebook. But we got this voicemail from Ed Hall in Atlanta, and I wanted to get your reaction to this, Ryan.
Of course there are ghosts. Now, are they wandering spirits or souls? Not persuaded of that. I suspect that they may be a function of quantum physics that we don't understand yet.
What do you think? I mean, obviously you believe in ghosts of some kind. What do you think they are?
You know, that's kind of a neat question. There are so many different types of spirits. You can't pinpoint it into one type. You know, we have the intelligent spirit that we're all normal or, you know, used to, where it's an intelligent spirit of someone that hasn't crossed over. But there are also residual hauntings where something tragic happens and it replays itself over and over like a psychic imprint. It's actually called the stone tape theory, where we believe something in the bedrock or in the ground actually holds memory and replays that event. Kind of similar to people hearing, you know, cannon fire at Gettysburg and stuff that still happens from tragic events that happened over 150 years ago.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that the place where you live is haunted, right?
Yes. We live about two blocks from Forsyth Park in downtown Savannah in a two-story old row house built in 1888. And there's been a little girl appear in our hallway numerous times. And, you know, my in-laws won't even come back to our house sometimes due to the activity. So that's kind of a plus.
I take it then you don't want to get rid of the ghost.
No, not that might be one reason to keep them there. So it's kind of a good thing.
I was not inviting any insults towards your in-laws, Ryan. Ryan Dunn is a lead investigator for the Savannah Ghost Research Society. But I want you to hang around, Ryan, because you also run a ghost tour called Afterlife Tours. And we were wondering the very thing that you mentioned earlier, whether or not ghosts are good for business and whether it pays off for a hotel to advertise, hey, we have ghosts. So we've brought in Molly Swagler. She's vice president of the Tourism Leadership Council. Good to talk to you again, Molly.
Hello, Celeste.
And Charlie Brazil is the general manager of the Old Town Trolley Tours of Savannah, and they turned their business's main office into a site for paranormal investigations also. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, good morning.
So, Charlie, let's start with the warehouse, the site where the Gribble House stood, and the Ghost Adventures team came and visited that warehouse. This is the site where three women were murdered in 1909. They were killed with an axe. Take a listen.
This all happened right there, where that exit sign is.
This structure here pretty much represents
where the house sat.
The square footage of the house.
No,
yeah,
what?
Exactly.
And you're telling me one of the bodies was found?
Right there.
Charlie, is your warehouse haunted?
Well, certainly a lot of people would say so, not only those experts who've gone and conducted investigations, but, you know, we operated business in that structure for many years, and there are a great number of employees, current and former, who have had odd experiences there. So I'd say the preponderance of individuals you asked who have had direct experience would say so.
So what do you think, Charlie, of the comment Ryan made earlier that ghosts are good for business? Would you agree with that?
Well, certainly. I mean, we also have a Ghosts and Gravestones tour that we run nightly. It's the most popular ghost tour in the city. And, you know, during this time of year, right around Halloween, we're doing 15 tours a night.
Wow.
And that is a direct result of people's interest in haunted heritage, which is kind of what we call it. You know, there may be a difference of opinion as to whether they're stories or reality, but there's definitely an interest there.
So, Molly, do we have any idea what kind of economic impact ghost hunters and ghost enthusiasts have on tourism in Savannah?
Right, the business of Boo in Savannah is pretty big. We don't have any numbers. You don't want to say Boo business too fast or you'll get in trouble. But we do have, I was looking at how many businesses run off of the Spectra specialization, and there are more than 50 in business here in Savannah. I don't have any numbers on the, what piece of the pie, the $2.5 billion industry that they hold, but it is big business, the business of Boo.
Charlie, what kind of people do you see coming for ghost tours? Are they generally people from out of town, or do people from Savannah and the area also come?
I think there's an interest that crosses both visitors, guest visitors, and locals alike. I think during this month, in October, we see a real uptick in locals who are trying to experience a little bit of a haunted heritage in their own backyard. Over the course of a year, you had asked about the numbers. On Ghosts and Gravestones last year, we carried almost 70,000 people.
Holy cow!
So that gives you an indication of the level of interest there.
So, Ryan, how do you make a living off of ghosts? I mean, number one, you said that a lot of your paranormal investigations are free. So how do you make a business out of this? Do you basically have to prove that ghosts are real? Is that part of the economic strategy?
No, all of our money comes from afterlife tours. You know, we're one of the top-rated tours on TripAdvisor, and we've been very successful with the tour company. And then also, coming from all of my writing, I've got a book that just came out, and I'm working on my sequel right now. So all of our funding comes through from our tours and from all of our books.
But is it necessary to be convincing that they're real ghosts, is what I'm trying to ask. In order to make a good business about it, do you need people that believe ghosts are real, or are you just trying to spook them?
No, we definitely want to show people that this is real. You know, we're very big on historical accuracy as well as catching real evidence and proving to people that what we have caught is legitimate. And we also invite the public on investigations, you know, quite a few times a year to join us and to show them they can experience it for themselves.
What about you, Charlie? Do you, with your tours, try to make a convincing case that these are real ghosts, or are you just telling spooky stories?
I think one of the challenges of providing a product that appeals to the ghost element is that there are guests who want to hear the historic heritage and the stories. There are guests who want to have the shock of a fun house. There are guests who are distinctly interested in the paranormal side, and we try through our various products to appeal to all of those. Obviously our role as a nation's storyteller with regard to the Ghosts and Gravestones tour, every single one of the stories that we tell on that tour have been verified in some sort of literary source, which there are abundant number of those out there. And then, of course, in the Gribble House location, we have a partner who provides a actual paranormal investigation there on a nightly basis. So we try to provide something that appeals to everybody.
So the answer is yes, ghosts can be very good for business. That's Charlie Brazil, general manager of the Old Town Trolley Tours of Savannah. Ryan Dunn is the lead investigator for the Savannah Ghost Research Society. And Molly Swagler is the vice president of the Tourism Leadership Council. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Thank you.
All hour, we've been hearing ghost stories, so here's one more spooky tale, this one from Nicholas Wood at the Sorrel Weed House Museum in Savannah.
Well, my name is Nicholas Wood. I'm the operations manager at the Sorrel Weed House Museum in Savannah, Georgia. One of the interesting things about the house is the fact that you can't go a day or a night without something unexplainable happening. Lately, since we've been acquiring a lot of artifacts and bringing them into the museum, we've noticed that it seems we might have a new apparition on the property. And it's got people concerned because one of the things that is commonly happening that we've never experienced before is things are starting to get thrown at us. You know, we've had a candle that was in the dining room that just sheared completely off, went flying off the sideboard table and across the room in front of guests during a tour. One of the very first experiences in the house for me, I had gotten comfortable with my routine. I operate on a routine, so I'm going through the house, I'm presenting their historical tales to guests, and all of a sudden a big old chunk of metal comes flying through the air from behind the tour guide and narrowly misses her head. And
six guests are watching this with their jaws on the floor. All of a sudden, some of us are getting pushed or tripped or just something seems to be trying to make itself known to us. And it's been getting kind of scary lately. I mean, we're quite used to paranormal activity, but lately there's something definitely going on in the house that is new even to us. And this particular evening, I broke my routine. I started opening up the house sort of in a backwards order. And I was very casual about it. Normally, I would be on my toes. You know, in the beginning, I was really scared, really freaked out by the house. And so I'd get through the house by myself as quickly as possible to get it set up. But this day, I was real comfortable, real casual. I was eating a Rice Krispie treat. I'm just going through the house easy-like, and I open up the library door, and right across the foyer is the entrance to the gentleman's parlor. Typically, most days, that door would be completely closed, but this day, I open up the library door, I look across the hall, and standing right in the doorway is an apparition, is a ghost, I guess the best way to describe it. I'm seeing a lady's dress. It's all belled out, very antebellum style, frilly, poofy shoulders with lots of lace. The dress, I could see it just as real as I could see anything else with my eyes. It had a small flower print on it, in fact. And I'm staring at this, and I'm blinking rapidly, and what I'm seeing wearing the dress is really just a shadow, but not like a dark shadow like you see cast against light. It was almost like a shadow, but white or just sort of opaque, the outline of a woman wearing this dress. And I was floored. I was absolutely so stunned. It happened so quickly, you don't have time to really be terrified or scared of what you're seeing. You just are trying to comprehend it. Blink 8 or 9 times and it just turns to mist and just disappears. At that point, I didn't know if I wanted to walk forward and continue opening up the house or if I wanted to turn around and get the heck out. Definitely one I'll never forget, my very first experience inside the Sorrelweed Mansion.
Nicholas Wood is the operations manager at the Sorrelweed House Museum in Savannah. And that's our show for today, but we always love to hear from you. If you have a good ghost story to share, and of course you do, give us a call at 404-500-9457 or find us on social media. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great Halloween.